BFFT. From the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with the bald-faced truth.
I want to thank everybody who has a place in their heart for the Bald-Faced Truth Foundation. It's been kind of a cool month and an inspiring month, seeing Camp Exceptional go down in July, and then subsequently, in the wake of that, a lot of people who hadn't heard about BFT Foundation have reached out and made donations online at baldfacetruth.org. Or even reached out to the nonprofit to say, hey, I want to make a recurring donation. And, you know, I grew up in the South Bay area of California. And I remember as a kid that we had lots of sports and musical instruments and drama club and theater at our school that, you know, we had the ability to participate in a lot of different things. And it cost money then. It wasn't all free, but it's not like it was now or is now, where football or basketball or baseball or playing an instrument, those are substantial costs for families, particularly families who are living paycheck to paycheck and having to make tough decisions with what activities their kids can participate in. At my high school in California, the high school was 50% Hispanic. It was an agricultural community. And some of that was driven by the fact that, you know, some of the kids that I went to elementary school with or middle school with or high school with were the children of migrant workers who were working in the agricultural industry. Or maybe there were people generations before that, you know, their grandparents were farm workers who had settled in the area after working there. And I didn't think much about it at the time, but I realize now looking back that some of those kids who were participating in sports, if they were participating, that the cost of even playing baseball or football or buying the cleats or, you know, spending the $40 or whatever was probably a staggering cost. And some of the schools that we would play against, you may be familiar with kind of the central Valley of California or maybe the Central Coast of California. And people like to talk about Carmel, California or Pebble Beach because, oh, it's got, you know, this great golf course and it's very affluent, nice area. That was not very far from where I grew up. It was like maybe 20, 25 miles away, 15, maybe 25 miles away, somewhere in there. Santa Cruz, not that far away from really my parents' house. And it was, We would play schools. There were two in particular that I remember. One was Gonzales, and it was over kind of in the Watsonville area, where tremendous agricultural area. You know, if you want to talk about lettuce and strawberries that you're probably eating when you go into the grocery store, just, you know, miles and miles of agricultural fields, and then Gonzales, and then another was La Salle. La Salle High School was over in the Salinas area. And John Steinbeck wrote a lot about Salinas and Monterey and the fields and the farm workers. And I can remember when we would go play games against La Salle or Gonzales, they were not competitive games. We would not pitch our best pitchers. We would not play all of our best players. And we would win those games 18 to nothing or 20 to nothing. And they were not competitive games. And I can remember at the time looking over into the other dugout and seeing the faces of the kids that were in the other dugout, and they were brown faces, and they were the children, literally, of people who were working in the fields, and their parents were not coming to the games. We would play at their stadium or their field. Really was a field, and it was like nobody came. And it, you know, to now I know why. Their parents were working. And I think about the mission of the BFT Foundation, and I see the faces of those kids in that dugout. And I hope we see those kids out there in our community who need us. So if you're somebody out there who knows a family who has kids that want to participate in sports or want to play a musical instrument or want to join a drama club, please direct them or find for them or tell their teacher about the Bald Faced Truth Foundation, baldfacedtruth.org. And secondarily, if you're out there and you're going, yeah, I'm doing all right now, and I would like to help somebody else, you can go to baldfacedtruth.org any day of the week, and you can make a tax-deductible donation online right there, just with a click of a button. You can set up a recurring donation if you'd like. And I just want to thank people who have done that. And I heard from a guy today, and he had the most interesting request, and he apparently wanted to donate $141.33. And he said, I would like to make that a recurring donation. And I'm not asking why. It's an interesting number. He must have a number in his mind that he could budget for down to the penny. And that means a lot. And, you know, I give a lot of my time. And sometimes we write checks. And, of course, during the summer, we're out there volunteering. And it's the best time I have helping other people. I can tell you, generationally, something I have been thinking about. Like, my grandfather was a big, big personality in my family. My Italian grandfather, he was the storyteller. He was the patriarch of the family. He was at the head of the table. He had the bottle of wine in front of him. You know, his voice was the loudest in the room, and such a big personality, like such a inspiration for a lot of us grandkids and certainly his own children who watched him kind of make a life, so to speak, as he would say. But I think about the impact of that. Like, even my two youngest children never met him. You know, he was 94 years old when he died, and my oldest daughter knew him, and she's one of eight great-grandchildren, and she only two of them ever got to meet him, even as young kids. And so I think about the time you and I are going to spend here on this planet, as we're alive. And I think about how fast generationally the world turns over. And, you know, my grandchildren will never have met him or know him. They'll know him, they'll know stories about him. They'll know pictures of him. But the impact that we all can have while we're here is profound. And so it's why I think, like, you know, this radio show's great. You listen to it. I love doing it. What I write at johnconzano.com is great. I love working for my readers. But the stuff that lasts is this BFT Foundation stuff. And so I really am grateful for people who are investing in children and investing in especially in kids who need the help. Let's play some Punch It audio.
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald Faced Truth headquarters. Hey, we're all about truth, justice, and the American way here, okay? Which is why we've spanned the globe and pulled the top audio cuts of the day.
You're going to hear little snippets of sound.
Hey, it's time for Punch It Audio. Presented by First Call Heating and Cooling.
Adam Schefter talking about the plantar fasciitis injury that Justin Herbert has. He's in a boot. Looks like he's going to shut it down for about 10 days. Here's Schefty. Punch it.
Let me say this. Number one, this is not how you want to start out your summer. This is not how you want to have your quarterback dealing with a walking boot if you're the new head coach of the Chargers, Jim Harbaugh. And this is the type of injury that stays with a player for a long period of time. Mm-hmm. He may be back for the regular season opener. That may be the expectation, but he's going to be playing through some discomfort in that foot, I think, potentially for the whole season.
Potentially for the whole season, or potentially the Chargers are doing the right thing by shutting him down. We don't know yet. Let's be fair. But Herbert looked good prior to putting the boot on. That's the thing. He ran for a touchdown on an 11-on-11 drill, celebrated with his teammates. Day later, he's in a boot. So I want to say this is a preventative thing until we hear otherwise, but I understand what Adam Schefter's doing. He's doing his job. And this could be potentially bad. Could be. Sean Payton talking about Bo Nix. How's Nix look? The early returns in Denver. Punch it.
Look, I thought overall, I'm sure there's going to be some plays we look at that were, it was mostly third down. A lot of the work was third down, but Yeah, I mean, we'll see the tape and evaluate it, but I thought overall pretty well. I mean, you know, there are clips, plays where you're going to look at and correct, and then there's others where you're going to say, hey, but I do have to watch the film because I'm looking at so much, and he ran with the ones, and I like his progress.
I like his progress, too, and I like the fact that he is an older rookie quarterback. He's got a lot more experience than a traditional rookie by NFL standards. He's the guy who started 61 games in college.
I was going to say, there's no chance he's not starting week one, right? Like, they're not going to start Jared Stidham or Zach Wilson in week one against the Seahawks.
Kind of feels to me like it's going to be Bo, unless something happens in camp. But he's running them with the ones. He's got the experience. They picked him sky high in the draft, top 10 pick in the draft. Just kind of feels like he's the guy, right? I mean, and I like that he's in Sean Payton's offense. I'm not sure how good they're going to be, but feels to me like they're going to ride or die with Bo Nix.
It feels like Nix is the type of guy who he's been around a lot of different offensive coordinators, a lot of head coaches. Like, he's very moldable, and I think that's what Sean Payton wants. Like, Russell Wilson's not going to be moldable to his offense, but Sean Payton can mold Bo Nix into what he wants as a quarterback, and he's going to build that offense around him. So I think he's in the best spot possible, but I'm with you. I don't know how great he's going to be. I could see him being really good, but I can also see him being very average. So the Broncos are a very intriguing team to me, and I can't wait to see him week one up in Seattle. Like, that's going to be a tough environment for Bo, but maybe they'll be up to the challenge.
It also feels to me like there's not a tremendous amount of pressure on Bo Nix because of how bad they were a year ago with,
There's more pressure on Sean Payton, I think. Yeah.
The other guy.
There's more pressure on Payton than there is on Nix, I feel like, because Payton got some of the blame for the Russell Wilson thing. It was bad last year.
I think he has a lot of incentive to make Bo Nix look good. Jackson Smith in Jigba. Talking about Ryan Grubb, offensive coordinator with your Seattle football team, wants to spread the ball around, punch it.
I mean, things are totally different, you know, just having the great Pete Carroll, you know, everything, and to now Mike McDonald, I mean, everything is different, both defensive-minded coaches, but, you know, Coach Mike McDonald's been defensive coordinator for about some years now, and really runs that, you know, side of the ball. And then also having Coach Ryan Grubb joining us, just, you know, you've seen the Washington offense just spreading it around, you know, a lot of deep shots, and, you know, just really playing offense on offense, you know.
Gonna be interesting to see how good Grubb is and how Smith and Jigba can be in that offense. I'm not sold that the Seahawks are a real contender in the way that maybe some Seahawks fans think they are, but they're an interesting team to me because of the change of coaching regime, Grubb being there. They've got some talent. They obviously won that Russell Wilson trade. A lot of compelling reasons to watch the Seahawks this year into them.
Yeah, and you think of Ryan Grubb and that Washington offense, if they really are going to spread it around and go deep, Seattle kind of has the pieces to do that with DK Metcalf, Tyler Lockett, and Jackson Smith and Jigba. Like, they have three really good receivers. And then, of course, they got Kenneth Walker and Zach Charbonnet in the backfield. That offense could be really good if Grubb is a good coach on offense on the NFL level. We knew how good he was at Washington, but can't translate to the NFL. If it can, I think that Seattle offense could be really good. The question would be defensively, can they stop anybody? But I think Njigba sounded excited to me, John. Like, they're going to start spreading out and take some shots.
Andy Staples, well aware that the Big Ten and others have gotten rid of divisions, SEC, Big Ten. They want to just play games, don't they? They want to play the best games. Andy Staples talking about how that changes scheduling in college football. No divisions. Punch it.
Yeah, the divisions are gone. So what you're used to were like, Georgia wins the SEC East every year. Well, there is no SEC East now. So Georgia, you know, maybe the best program in the SEC the last few years, got the unlucky draw. They've got to go to Alabama, to Texas, and to Ole Miss, which is just brutal. Texas, meanwhile, first year in the SEC, you think, okay, let's haze the new guy. Nope, they got a pretty easy draw. Meanwhile, Oklahoma, the other new guy in the SEC, their schedule just sucks. Like, Tennessee comes to them. They have to go to Auburn the following week. Their last 2 weeks of the season are Alabama comes to them, and then they go to LSU.
Big Ten doing the same thing, and it'll also affect who gets into the championship game, because now it's not going to be like the fourth best team in the Big Ten played in the Big Ten West getting into the title game. It's just going to be the two highest rated teams by CFP metrics. I think it's going to be a really controversial year. I think there's going to be a lot of debate down the stretch in the SEC and the Big Ten as to who the second team should be in those championship games, because they're not all playing each other. SEC is only playing an 8-game conference schedule. Big Ten's playing a 9-game conference schedule. Everybody playing everybody is a thing of the past, and yet they're going to have to try to figure out who belongs in the title game. So good luck to us all. Speaking of good luck to Oregon State's quarterbacks, Ryan Gunderson, the coordinator at Oregon State, talking about what he needs to get out of his QBs. Punch it.
I want guys who are going to make good decisions. When we make a good call against the right defense, they're going to make the play. So that's decision-making, that's avoiding turnovers, avoiding sacks, keeping us moving forward. And then when we are in a bad situation, not making a bad play worse. We don't want critical errors. There's going to be interceptions sometimes where you throw it and it gets tipped and it goes up in the air and it gets picked. We want to avoid the critical errors that are bad decisions that lead to bad throws, that lead to turnovers. So that's really what it is for me. Guys who can keep us moving forward and really good decision-makers.
I don't hear either Trent Bray or Ryan Gunderson saying, I need a prolific playmaker at that position. I hear them advocating for a Jeff Hostetler, a Trent Dilfer, a Jim McMahon. They want a guy who's not going to hurt them and make bad plays. Guy who's going to make the right play, not turn the ball over. Steven, you're hearing the same thing out of Oregon State? Because I don't know if they have a guy who's dynamic. They don't have an Aiden Childs right now.
Yeah, I'm hearing the same thing. And, you know, you listen to and you read some of the people that were down there at the practices. They said Gulbranson looked the best out of all the quarterbacks. And they said he actually looked like he was improved and was making some throws he hadn't made in the past. But it makes me question, John, when I hear those type of things, either Trent Bray and Ryan Gunderson think that the defense is going to be elite, so they don't need to have a guy make plays, or they just don't have that guy
on
the roster.
They don't have it. You saw the spring game. Gulbranson didn't play, but those other guys aren't ready.
So you think it's more that they just don't have the playmaker, rather than the defense is going to be that elite, they don't need mistakes?
I think they're saying, we don't have the playmaker, so we're going to go with the guy who's not going to kill us. And the schedule's going to be more favorable. We think if we play defense and they run the ball and they don't make mistakes, they should be able to win, you know, they should be able to win some games. And it's true, when you look at their schedule, let's be real, I got their schedule in front of me. You know, they will beat Idaho State playing that way. They may be able to beat San Diego State on the road playing that way. They're not going to win the Civil War playing that way. They might be able to beat Purdue, a bad Big Ten team at home, playing that way. They might be able to potentially beat Colorado State at home playing that way, although I'm skeptical because I think Colorado State's going to be decent. They can win at Nevada playing that way. They can beat UNLV maybe at home playing that way. Maybe they're in the game. UNLV's good, but I think they can hold their own against the Mountain West teams that are decent. Can they win at Cal playing that way? Maybe. Maybe. But San Jose State, they can beat playing that way. They're in the Air Force game playing that way. And you get where I'm going. I mean, schedule's easier.
And that's the thing, is there's some good teams in the Mountain West. I mean, UNLV, they play Houston week one. They're only 2.5-point underdogs on the road at Houston.
They're good.
So they're a good team. I think the question for me, John, now is the Idaho State game, it is whatever. I'm not really counting that. When they're week two at San Diego State, is Ben Gulbranson the starting quarterback? Right now, after two practices, is really early to say, would you say he's the quarterback?
Yeah, I think he's their guy. He's their guy. I think he's going to be their guy. And I think, look, it's Boise State, UNLV, Fresno State, Air Force, Colorado State at the top of that conference. So they get some games like the San Diego State game, the San Jose State game, and the Nevada game. They should clean up. in those games. So now it comes down to, can you, as you are constructed as a, you know, you want to fund like a Power Five, you want to be a Power Five, can you get on the field with UNLV and Air Force and hold your own? You can if you play Gulbranson there, but I don't love the quarterback room at Oregon State. It's why when they signed class of 26, Deegan Rose, four-star guy who Oregon had offered, and Rose chose Oregon State, I went, that is a big get, because that's a guy who's going to come in as a freshman. If he adheres to that agreement, 2 years from now, he is the starter at Oregon State as a freshman. So keep an eye on that. Dan Lanning at Oregon. How did his first workout, his first practice go? Punch it.
I think we're going to bring great effort, enthusiasm. Now we got to go in here and coach the technique that we saw. But I wanted to make sure we're not walking out here and running 15 defenses that we can't run, that we bust every time, or 15 plays on offense that don't work because we're not running the right route or not blocking the proper guy. And I didn't see that today. I saw guys execute at a high level, which is the expectation.
Oregon's plan for different stakes. I thought it was interesting yesterday when Austin Meek came on the show. And he said, hey, man, I don't know how tuned in Michigan is to Oregon. Michigan's worried about Ohio State all the time. If Oregon's going to be worth a damn, that needs to change. Everybody needs to be worried about Oregon, because I love the idea of Oregon flying under the radar. But Dan Lanning playing for different stakes. And don't at me for bringing up Jeff Hostetler and Jim McMahon and Trent Dilfer. Those are better approximations for Ben Gulbranson. Then who's the safe and steady quarterback? I'm not going to say it's Brock Purdy, because Brock Purdy, I think, is a better playmaker than Ben Gulbranson was in his year of starting, even though Oregon State, you know, I think they were 7-1 with Golby starting.
It's like Alex Smith.
Okay. It's a more recent approximation.
I'm trying to think, like, right now. I mean, Kirk Cousins is better.
I'm literally thinking of like a Super Bowl that the Baltimore Ravens won with Trent Dilfer at quarterback, where the job was, hand the ball off, execute the plays. When we make a good call, execute the play, hit the open receiver, don't throw a pick, don't fumble. And, you know, that was kind of the year that Gulbranson had 2 years ago. They won games with him throwing for like 112 yards and not his fault. He had running backs all around him, grown out of his ears. But that's kind of the job at Oregon State, you know?
Well, think back to that year, too. Had he started against USC and done that job, he would have won that game against USC. Because yes. Chance Nolan threw five picks in that game, whatever it was.
Don't even get me started. Chance Nolan, what a disappointment that was. Aptly named Chance. Christian Capel is coming up next. Covers the University of Washington. We're going to check in with the Huskies. Take the temperature. Are they circling that Oregon game on their calendar or what? Leave it here.
LASIK and ICL. Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
If you're not happy in your locker room, you can leave the locker room. You're not obligated to stay 4 or 5 years any longer. You have the ability to seek certain things if you're a player. I mean, all these things are great. And yet we're on national TV, what, Thursday nights, Friday nights, Saturday nights, Tuesday nights for some conferences. I just think we're in a great spot. Now there are some things that have to be worked on. We have to figure out how to have a little bit of maybe some level playing field when it comes to understanding contracts or understanding how are we going to negotiate with kids that don't have lawyers or don't have agents. They're not NFL players. We have to figure out how we're going to make sure that kids are taken care of appropriately and you don't run into these weird contracts between other universities. But I think college football is in an amazing spot right now. And if you're coaching in the Big Ten, you're coaching in the SEC, I think you're a pretty happy guy.
That is Jed Fish. He's now at Washington joining us to talk about it. Christian Capel on Montlake.com. He is the go-to for University of Washington football coverage. How's Jed Fish been in the early days of camp here?
Yeah, pretty spirited, I would say. These first 2 days, it's kind of funny, you know, you can look forward to the start of training camp and the position battles and how are they going to look. And these first 2 days have really been focused on fundamentals and drills and install. They have not taken a single rep through 2 days of 11 on 11 or 7 on 7 stuff. But we were able, you know, we were watching practice today, and you could hear Jed Fish when he gathered the team at the end of the day, was emphasizing nutrition and wants guys to eat more, you know, eat more breakfast and you know, get bigger, wants a bigger team to compete in the Big Ten and to make sure they recover and rest well and everything. And he did say that, you know, it kind of starts in earnest tomorrow. They put the pads on. There's going to be more competition. They're going to be more getting after it. He was kind of getting after him today to pick the energy up a little bit. I think, you know, he, in any coach's perfect world, you don't need to have the pads on and lining up 11 on 11 to bring the energy of practice, but that's not always the case. But it sounds like they're ready to ramp it up a little bit tomorrow.
Give me an idea where the biggest questions position-wise arise in your mind.
Yeah, I mean, on the offensive line, certainly, and some of that is due to health. They've got a couple guys, Landon Hatchett, guard Memelar, who I think they see as starters or starter caliber, who weren't around for the spring due to injury, and they're both kind of working their way back, and we'll kind of, you know, we'll see if those guys can play in the opener. Fish has said he's hopeful, but it's no sure thing. They brought in three transfers, Enoch Bimahi, who's a guard from Ohio State, who looks like he's probably going to start, but there's a, you know, there's a couple positions, left tackle that's up for grabs, and you know, there's going to be some battles, and not just figuring out who their best five are, but also figuring out where those five best fit, because it's a bunch of guys who haven't played football together before. It's not even this spring. So that's probably the biggest focus. I mean, they got, I think, three starter caliber players at cornerback for two spots there. They brought in two veteran transfer safeties, so I'm sure are expecting to play, but I would also bring back some pretty experienced safeties who have played a lot of Washington before. So some good competition in the back end. They got some stuff to figure out in the defensive interior, too. I mean, they brought in transfers really just even through the spring window at basically every position, so with the exception of a couple. So there's some guys who you know, our receiver, Denzel Boston, Jeremiah Hunter, Giles Jackson, you know, you kind of know who the guys are going to be, a linebacker, but elsewhere there's still some stuff to sort out.
Christian, the Michael Penix void, is that the biggest loss, or do you look at, like, you know, just the coaching staff, Ryan Grubb, the overall turnover, you know, being a more, I guess, impactful thing than sort of some of the players who have moved on, you know, all those draft picks that left Washington? Is it more about the transition of coaching staff than the transition of talent, or is that a weird question?
Yeah, I mean, I've been reminding people, honestly, since before last season even ended, that, and then especially after Kalen DeBoer left, but just saying, hey, you know, I know all these guys who have gone in the portal and what they've lost through the draft. You got to remember, even if there wasn't a coaching change, this was still going to be a rebuild this year.
Yes.
You know, they still had gone out and had gotten Will Rogers from Mississippi State to replace Michael Penix and had their guys in the pipeline at receiver. And it was going to be a big transfer year for them. They were going to be, had been, and were going to be to an even greater degree, really busy in the portal to fill things out and bring in and build a roster going into the year one in the Big Ten. Obviously the coaching change exacerbated that and made it so that I think 84 scholarship guys and only 44 of them were on the roster at Washington last season. So it wouldn't have been that big of a turnover. But, you know, yeah, I mean, I think you kind of knew that that some shift was coming. You knew that, you know, you only had – really, I thought they got a year more out of Penix than anybody probably expected. I don't think anyone thought he would really stick around for 2 years necessarily. So the losing the coaching staff, I think, was the bigger deal. I mean, big picture-wise, that disrupted – things across the entire roster at every position, and there's a lot of guys playing football at other schools right now who would probably still be at Washington if Kalen DeBoer were the head coach.
I left Big Ten Media Day higher on Washington than I entered it, in part because I just liked how put together Jed Fish was, and you know, the guy knows what he's doing. He sounded confident. I don't know if that has anything really to do with what's going to happen on the field, but Did your mind shift at all going in, leaving? Because I looked around and saw Rutgers in Maryland and Illinois and Indiana, and I thought, there's some wins out there.
Yeah, I mean, this first Big Ten schedule for them, they kind of get to experience the haves and the have-nots of the conference, right? They got to go to Oregon at the end of the year. They got to host Michigan. They got to go to Penn State. They got to go to Iowa. But they also host Northwestern, and they go to Rutgers, and they go to Indiana. Now, that Rutgers game is probably looking a little trickier than you might have been convinced 2 years ago if someone told you they're playing Rutgers in a couple of years. I think they got things turned around there last year and got a star running back, and their arrow, you know, they're recruiting well, and their arrow is kind of pointing up. But, you know, it's a tough schedule. It's not a week-in, week-out gauntlet. You're right. There are some gettable games, and, you know, they don't have a big-time marquee non-conference opponent. And then they open with Big Ten play with Northwestern and go to Rutgers. So I know a lot of Husky fans saw that schedule when it first came out, and this was before Kalen DeBoer left and all that, but it saw that schedule and thought, that should be a 5-0 start. And then Michigan comes to Husky Stadium, and it's sort of game on from there. They host USC too. UCLA comes to Seattle. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know that I feel terribly different about them than I did in the spring necessarily. I think they added some interesting players. They added some length and some athleticism. Jed Fish has really hammered that they want size. They want big guys, I think, across the board. And, you know, they went out and got some guys defensively who I think are versatile, who kind of fall in that with Steve Belichick as their defensive coordinator, fall in that New England Patriots category of can play multiple positions and can move around. He can do different things with them and put them in different packages. So I'm eager to see how that all comes together. I think Jed Fish feels like they have a talented team. But right now it's a collection of individuals, and, you know, over this next month or so, they're going to try to make it a team.
I want to look at that early season game, Apple Cup, September 14th. 12:30 kickoff on the schedule. Pat Chun, the athletic director there at Washington, says, you know, he expects ticket sales to pick up in front of that game. What do you think is keeping ticket sales down for that game right now?
Well, they're really expensive. I mean, that's the biggest factor. You know, I wrote a little about this a while back. I mean, Washington and Washington State, because remember, this is a neutral site game. It's not a home game for either of those teams. They are splitting the ticket sales, at least initially, and they're splitting the revenue 50-50 from all ticket sales. So it's not included in either school's season ticket package. And I think a lot of season ticket holders, at least from a Washington perspective, you know, they're used to paying what they pay for their season tickets, including their seat-related donation, you know, whatever that total is, and getting seven games. And this year, it's only six games, and now on top of it, you're being asked to spend, you know, if you want to sit between the goal lines, you're looking at a couple $100 a ticket for the most part. Club seats are in the $300 to $400 range. And it's not necessarily that those seats are so much more expensive than they would be on a per game basis for like a UW season ticket holder who sits in those sections. But when it's on top of a season ticket price that you already paid for, even though it is, you know, a seventh game and everything, I think it feels like a lot for people. And it's also, it's not the same product, right? It's the Apple Cup, it's Washington and Washington State, but it's not the regular season finale to a long college football season played on a campus the weekend of Thanksgiving, like it always has been. It's not a conference game. I think some shine has come off of it a little bit. And so from a Washington perspective, I know I've heard from a ton of fans who just don't see it as worth the price necessarily. And, you know, I think there's a lot of Wazoo fans who would just as soon never see Washington again. So I think that's factoring into it too.
Is that a close game in your mind?
I don't think there's any reason to believe that Washington's going to go in and steamroll them. You know, Wazoo is a program that has recruited and competed at a 500 or above 500 level at the Power 5 level for a while now. So, you know, their future's uncertain, but that roster didn't just become you know, a less than Power 5 roster overnight. There's still some talent on that team. I know John Mateer was an interesting guy at quarterback when he got into some games last year. I assume he'll win that job there. There's going to be all kinds of emotion, right? I mean, for Washington State playing a majority Mountain West schedule this year, that's their marquee game. You know, that's probably the best team they're going to play this year. I know there's some decent Mountain West programs too, but you know, it's still a rivalry game. There's, I imagine, a lot more, even more bitter feelings than there usually are around that. I'm sure Wazoo's going to be fired up for it. Until I see Washington's offense at work and kind of see how the trenches come together, especially the offensive line, I don't know that you're talking about them really, you know, blowing by too many opponents this year.
The Oregon game at the end of the year is a rivalry game. In most years, I think Oregon fans would have that game circled, but they do not this year, Christian. They are circling Ohio State. They're talking about Wisconsin. They go to Michigan. How does the Oregon game sit in the eyes of Washington fans as it sits on the schedule?
Yeah, I think, whereas last year it was so easy to point to that, right? And you look at Oregon's schedule and Washington's schedule, and okay, both these teams are going to be 5-0 going into this game. They're going to be coming off a bye. They're both loaded, top 10. I mean, this is going to be an awesome game. I think the perspective on Washington's schedule this year is a little bit more like, hey, there's some other stuff to do first, right? I mean, the fact that it's the finale and that's now the Thanksgiving weekend rivalry game, people are thinking about that first trip to Rutgers, and people are thinking about the rematch against Michigan at Husky Stadium and how tough the Iowa trip is going to be, and they're the whiteout game on the road against Penn State. So I think there's so many like milestones and big games and really challenging, difficult games on the schedule before Oregon that I don't know that anybody's necessarily got that circle just because there's so many other high-profile hurdles before then. But, yeah, it's going to be weird. You know, I like that, and it was an obvious move, but you know, I like that they've settled on that being the last game for each team now. I mean, it's not the Apple Cup. It's going to take some getting used to, but it is. I think it'll be fun that when you get to game 12, you know, that regular season finale, that you know you're getting Washington-Oregon as part of that weekend.
Christian Kafel covers Washington. His website, onmontlake.com, does a great job covering that program. If you want to know what's going on with Washington, make sure you're following his work. Christian, the departure of DeBoer, you mentioned it. A lot of Oregon State fans mad at Jonathan Smith for leaving, but understand why. Washington State fans mad at Pat Chun for leaving. But down deep, they understand why. Does the Washington fan down deep understand why Kalen DeBoer did what he did, or is there still some lingering feelings?
It depends which of them you talk to, I think.
Right?
I think there is a more pragmatic crowd that says, oh, look, it's Alabama, you know, and it's Alabama after Nick Saban. See, the way I've always looked at it is, I think – it's easy to say, well, that's, you don't want to be the guy to follow the legend, right? That's always the conventional wisdom. Knowing Kalen DeBoer, I would think that was probably a selling point for him. That, look, hey, only one person. I mean, Alabama's going to have coaches and coaches and coaches throughout the rest of time here as college football is played. But only one person gets to be the guy who follows Nick Saban and try to take the torch and keep it going and win championships and, you know, prove that you can do that. And I think Kalen DeBoer is a competitive, confident enough guy that I think he takes that challenge head on. I would bet that was an enticing factor and not a detriment for him. But, there are still Husky fans, I think, who look and say, gosh, you had a huge contract put in front of you. You took this program right to the national championship game. So, you know it can be done. Everything you want to achieve in college football is here. Look, the school's going to the Big Ten. You know, you could have stayed here forever and won big and had a statue built for you. But I do think deep down for most people there's an understanding that, look, you want to coach at the very highest level and Alabama comes open and they want you to be the guy to follow Nick Saban. For somebody cut from Kalen DeBoer's cloth, that's a difficult thing to say no to.
I guess I want to know, I had things that I thought about that crossed my mind at Big Ten Media Days that I had not considered before. Did you leave there thinking about anything that maybe you hadn't considered, or what was that experience like for you to kind of get a taste of what that conference is about?
Yeah, I mean, it was, for me, it was a pretty quick trip. I remember when the schedule came out, seeing, okay, it's 3 days and Washington goes the last day. Yeah, I don't really need to be there on Tuesday and Wednesday. I'm going in Wednesday night. I'll cover Washington's time there. It's interesting, the contrast between Washington and Oregon. They're the two Northwest schools. They were the cream of the crop in the Pac-12 last year. They played two really, I mean, just awesome, close football games. And it's Oregon that comes in. You know, Washington won both of those and got to the national title game, but it's Oregon that comes into the Big Ten with most of the fanfare. I don't know. I mean, was it your impression on that Thursday? It kind of seemed like Oregon was the big deal that day. And I know Michigan talked that day too, and there's always going to be a lot of attention around Michigan, but it kind of seemed like Oregon, at least among the six teams who spoke that Thursday, you know, sort of was the center of gravity a little bit there.
Yeah, it was. And I even think it started 2 days earlier because they threw that duck in the river and people got asked about Oregon. It was really smart by Oregon. And then day two kind of became about, is USC, do they belong on that upper echelon, you know, with Ohio State and Oregon? And the prevailing thought was, no, they aren't. They don't deserve to be there right now. And that kind of became a storyline. And then Thursday, yeah, you're right, it was all about Oregon. But I thought Jed Fish and Dan Lanning, when they got up there, Christian, both of them were really impressive. I thought they were two of the more impressive coaches among the, you know, bazillion coaches who spoke, the 18 coaches who spoke. It's just weird to see that over 3 days. But really strong, charismatic people up on the stage.
Yeah, you know, both were very prepared, I think very comfortable with that role. It's one thing to coach football and love the X's and O's and love the relationship building and, you know, being in the trenches with the players and all those sorts of things, and you need to be all that to be a great coach. But I do think that both Fish and Lanning kind of embrace the you know, I don't want to say political, but it is a political job. Chris Peterson said that all the time, that, look, this is a political job and I'm not a political person, so I hate the political part of it. But yeah, I mean, there is a political, like, and also sales element to it, where you're representing your program anytime you get to put on a suit and tie and talk about him in public. And I think those two guys, you know, very on message. They had their talking points that they wanted to get across, and they hit him well. I think Jed Fish was wise to nod to the last couple years, that as much, you know, all the talk about Washington since January 9th, the day after the title game, has been future, future, future. And I think that's rubbed some people out here the wrong way, that it looked, you know, this team went 14-1 last year, and because the coach left, that all anybody wants to talk about is the roster and, you know, going to the Big Ten and next year. And it seemed like the world sort of moved on from Washington 2023 season before a lot of people around Washington were ready to. So I think for Fish to get up there and say, hey, you know, he talked about the roster and he talked about the transfers and the Arizona influence and all that and all the newness that they were going to have to meld together, but also said, you know, this program has beaten Oregon three times in a row. This program's beaten Texas the last two times they played. He pulled out too. I mean, he had to dig deep for this one, but they've beaten USC the last two times they played. You got to go back to 2019 for the second meeting, but today, you know, they're 25-3 in their last two seasons, and look, it's still Washington, and, you know, just because so much has changed, it can still be that kind of program. I thought that was a nice little nod to the coaching staff that preceded him there.
Christian Capel, you do a fantastic job. Yeah, on Montlake.com, keep up the fight, man. You're turning out great work. I don't think there's anybody better on that beat. So if you want to know what's going on Montlake.com, follow him on Twitter. Christian Capel, thank you.
All right, thank you.
There he goes. I love that. I love that we checked in with Washington State, checked in with Washington. Oh, we're getting to Oregon State and Oregon. We are. Keith Hayward, the defensive coordinator at Oregon State, due on the show tomorrow. Leave it here. You got the BFT.
Hey, yo.
Got the home of the truth. Back to the bald-faced truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
top of the hour, Anna will be joining us, making her triumphant return to this radio program. I don't know. It's against medical advice. She's on concussion protocol. If, Steven, I hope you're ready. If she gets like two into this and I go number two and she goes, didn't we finish? Then you're on. That's the cue for you.
All right, I'll be prepared.
Okay. Not to make light of a concussion situation, but I just did. This is a serious thing. We have been trying to not throw too much at her, but I have noticed she's, I'll say this when she's not in here, she's not quite Anna. So I hope people stick around just to see if she's able to pull this off. You know, we recently celebrated an anniversary a couple days ago, and I said to her, how did you like the trip? She looked at me confused because we hadn't been on a trip. I don't know if it's good to make fun of someone who's had a concussion. Again, I'm not saying you should do that. It's a serious thing. I've had a concussion. It's no fun. But she got in a little car accident. She got rear-ended. We're about to find out if she's still got it. The 5 at 5 is coming up. Leave it right here. Hey, John Canzano.
BFFT. From the PAC West Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
So it was like 5 days ago, Anna was driving. She got rear-ended and walked away feeling like she had whiplash, concussion-like symptoms. She ended up in the ER feeling a little nauseous, a little dizzy, a little confused. She's going to make her return here, and she's sitting beside me in the studio. But I have to say this. Steven, you were a witness to this just a moment ago. She asked me a question that makes me question whether I'm doing something irresponsible here. She said, how do you say when a person has the batting average 0.168, do you say the point? Or do you say 168, Anna?
I don't know that. That did doesn't not, have anything to do with a concussion.
Did you not know that before?
Not really. I've always sort of avoided it. I've skirted around it because I wasn't sure the proper way to say it. Just like with golf, I don't understand how to speak golf either. And so you'll notice if I ever do golf or baseball stories, I get kind of fuzzy about the numbers. I don't know how to do the lingo.
We're going to try to keep this basic for you. Simple. How are you feeling?
Tell people how you're feeling. I don't know if that's really that much different from before I had the concussion.
I feel like the 0.168, I feel like that's a fair question.
Thank you. I'm okay. I definitely feel like I am speaking at a lower rate of speech. That's the main thing that I've noticed. Like, it's taking a lot more concentration for me to put my words together. Mm. And also, multitasking sucks. So for anybody who's ever had a concussion, I guess you can relate.
Do you feel like you're out of the woods, or do you feel like you're kind of...
No, I don't.
We shouldn't be doing this then.
There's moments where I feel okay, but it's usually around this time in the afternoon where I start to go, okay.
Well, it is later in the day. I've had a concussion, yeah. And that is a later in the day thing.
Yeah.
Because you start to get...
It's the mental fatigue.
Yeah, you're just kind of, it's a cumulative effect.
Yeah, but this is not an excuse for you to question everything I say, to be like, are you okay? Are you okay?
Mm-hmm. Are you okay?
I'm fine.
We're taking notes over here.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what have you been told by the ER doctors and the other doctors you have seen?
They just said, they did a CT scan, it was clear. They said, my neck's pretty screwed up, and then... the chiropractor did an adjustment, which I forgot. I don't normally go to a chiropractor, and it's been years since I've gone to one. Like, I think, like, multiple decades since I've gone to one. I forgot what that process is like. And then all of a sudden, she's making a lot of noise with my bones, and I uttered some expletives loudly.
Oh, really?
In the office. Yes. Yes. I don't know why I forgot that this is what a chiropractor does, but I wasn't quite expecting it to happen. And, you know, whatever. It's good. It's all good.
All right. So against my better judgment, we're like a football coach that has a quarterback that has a concussion, and we're going, you know what? Can she go?
That's me. I'm the quarterback in this scenario.
But it's the Super Bowl. We got to win. So, you know, we need to get the starters out there.
It's the 5-5.
Let's lower the stakes a little, shall we?
We have to have you. You
guys have been fine without me.
We've cruised along.
As a guy who filled in for you, it's been okay.
Steven, let's do the 5. I hope we get through it. At 5.
The 5 at 5.
We're going to go in order, Anna.
Number 1.
1 through 5?
Yep.
Thank you.
There you go.
Thank you for speaking to me that way. Well, I was asking the question about the batting average because I wanted to talk about the Mariners' Mitch Garver. He's opening up, and he's kind of emotional, talking about his season so far. The Mariners lost to the Red Sox on Wednesday night. You know, Garver came to Seattle in the offseason after winning the World Series with the Rangers. He signed a 2-year, $24 million deal, but he has not done well here in the Pacific Northwest. He's batting 168 in 89 games so far, and it is an average so poor that not even his 12 home runs and 38 RBIs can offset it. So he's just saying, I mean, he literally is saying he is in a slump. It's the hardest he's ever had to grind. It's the worst he's ever played in his career. But here's what I think is interesting. He says it's tough on him and his family with the death threats.
Ooh.
The retire, you suck, kill yourself. I mean, really, all of this. He says it's getting old, and the only way he knows that he can change it is to play better, but he's not going to quit.
All right, so he hit 270 last year. In a full season, okay? He played 87 games, so he hit 270, all right? But let's look at his numbers historically. His first year, he hit 196. In 2020, he hit 167. So I would argue that he has been worse than 168,
okay?
Technically. He hit 207 in 2022. I kind of think what Mitch Garver did was he had a really good year last year, hit 270 on a team that was really good around him, and he capitalized with a contract, and he's gone to a team where he doesn't have as much around him in the lineup, and he's once again turned back into Mitch Garver. He is a career 238 hitter. So he's hitting, you know, 50 points below his career average, but I would argue if he was hitting about 220, we wouldn't be having this conversation. I don't think he should get death threats, though. I think that's, you know, it's way out of line. It's weird. Hope that that is not happening on the scale that he says it's happening. But he is, he's got 109 strikeouts this year. That is far more than he's had at any juncture of his career. He's striking out at a higher rate, but he has the same number of at bats right now that he had last year, and he's got 30 fewer hits. So he is having, compared to last year, a really bad year. But
I like what he's saying, though. Like, I like that he's saying, I've never quit anything. I'm not going to quit this. They're going to have to rip the jersey off my back. He's saying, I could happily go retire and live a great life with my family, but I made a 2-year commitment to this team. They believe in me.
I think he's going to finish the season hitting around 200. But I think, you know, he's not... He just needs a few hits to fall here and there. The averages usually work out, but he's a 238 career hitter. I'm going to make a prediction, Steven. Mitch Garver's going to hit 205. That's where he will end up at the end of the season.
Let's write that one down.
205. Bold prediction. Tell Mitch Garver I believe in him so much that I think he's a 205 hitter.
Number 2.
Well, Colorado's at it again for the second time in 2 years now. You know, this is the team that Dan Lanning was saying was playing for clicks. Remember that one?
Yeah. Substance. We're substance, he said.
Rooted in substance. Colorado once again has their players' social media handles on the back of their practice jerseys. So, like, Shedeur Sanders, instead of just Sanders, has at Shedeur Sanders, you know, at Mark Vassett. Each member of the football team has their Instagram handle.
You're sounding a little foggy there, but you got through that one, and you were just really slow delivering that one. Not your normal.
I'll try to pick it up.
Self. But the point being that it's, you know, there's so much in college athletics and pro sports that is about the individual and not the team. And I don't want to sound like an old guy on my lawn, but it is a diversion from what used to be across all sports. You have individuals worried about their own name, image, likeness, their own podcast, their own Instagram handle. And amid that, you're asking them to be good teammates. We'll see how that plays out for a Colorado team that I think is going to be tested in the season opener. They've got North Dakota State in the season opener. That is a really dicey opener for a Colorado team that has not played disciplined, buttoned-up football. And North Dakota State, it's their Super Bowl. And they're a really good lower-division team. They're going to come out and throw some punches. Let's see what Colorado's got.
Isn't it Notre Dame and, like, Penn State? They don't have names on their jerseys,
no
is what
names.
I recall.
Yeah. Yep.
And I've always liked that because it's more about their team than it was about the individual, right?
Yes.
But it's like now you have, like, every little league team, every, like, did you ever have your name on your jersey on little league teams?
Not on a little league team. No.
Like, that's all changed.
But look what happened. Like, little leaguers are getting baseball cards. That started a long time ago. It was all about, like, trying to be like the pros. But I think there's a real shift in mindset. It's about the individual so much more now than it was.
Yeah.
In college sports. We shall see.
Number three.
Okay, you probably mentioned this earlier, but it's worth talking about. Katie Ledecky, now in the history books as the most decorated American female in Olympic history. Her 4x200 freestyle relay team captured the silver medal behind Australia today. And with it, she earned her 13th Olympic medal. That is the most won by an individual American woman over a career and the most of any female swimmer in Olympic history.
I want to know what you make of this. Stolen valor. You know what that is.
Yes.
How about the ACC Twitter account?
Is what that is.
Tweeting out, Ledecky bringing home the gold. Hashtag Olympians made here. Stanford's not even an official member of the ACC until tomorrow. Katie Ledecky graduated from Stanford in 2021. She will not swim in an ACC pool.
So dumb.
Is it stolen valor?
It is. I get it. They are all about promoting, you know, their conference and claiming championships and medals and whatnot. I get it, but it's just so cheap. And I keep pointing out to you as we're watching these Olympics, because this is our nightly ritual right now, as it is for many families, is to plop down on a couch, eat bad food, and watch athletes, you know, compete at high levels. But I keep pointing out to you when they talk about the schools that these, you know, athletes are competing at. I'm like, oh, that was a Pac-12 school. Look at that. That's a Pac-12 athlete. You know, it's not lost on me. And maybe I'm listening for it harder. But
yeah, I think there's a lot of that out there. And look back, even one Olympics ago, 90 medals won by Pac-12 athletes. They'll now be claimed by the Big 12, ACC, and others. But I wonder, and mark my words, 4 years from now, 8 years from now, 12 years from now, if we're not having the same success we had in the Olympics, if nobody's mentioning the fact that the Pac-12 Olympic sports, no longer on the Pac-12 network, no longer subsidized by the Pac-12 universities the way they once were, then you're missing the point. I think this is going to impact our nationalism. It's going to impact the Olympic performance we have, and China and Russia will get the last laugh if that comes to be true.
I mean, even look at, you know, the French swimmer that just won two gold medals in 2 hours. Like, I took note when they were like, oh, yeah.
Arizona State.
Yeah. You know, like,
Big 12 didn't miss it. Big 12 said, there we are. Hashtag Olympians made here. Yeah.
That's just they so did. Cheap.
Stolen valor.
It's so cheap.
Put a camera on Brett Yormark and be like, you didn't win that Purple Heart. What are you doing? You weren't a Ranger.
Number four.
That's not the same thing. Okay. Let's real quick stick with the Olympics just because I find it odd that these triathletes are having to compete in this polluted river, the Seine River. There's been a lot of coverage of this, obviously. The Seine River in France, these triathletes had to swim in it. This thing, you know, was well chronicled. It had E. coli and other bacteria rising above acceptable levels heading into the summer's games. In fact, Tuesday had a postponement because of the pollution. And then by Wednesday, the water was deemed safe to swim in. But there's a Belgian swimmer, Jolien Vermeulen. Now, she didn't finish great. She finished 24th, but she's very vocal. She's blasting Olympic officials who made the call to hold this race. She said, "While swimming under the bridge, I felt and saw things that we shouldn't think about too much."
Oh, boy.
Can you imagine?
No, I don't want to imagine.
She said, "I drank a lot of water, so we'll know tomorrow if I'm sick or not. It doesn't taste like Coca-Cola or Sprite, of course. The Seine has been dirty for 100 years, so they can't say the safety of the athletes is a priority." That is bull. Mm.
It's like swimming in the Willamette, the lower Willamette.
Well, there was an American who said he hadn't been washing his hands to prepare for the E. coli.
We've seen it all.
He was trying to create immunity for
himself. Yeah, that's what he said. He said it's been backed up by science that if you just, you know, gradually do this, that you'll be okay. And so he said by the time he was swimming in it, like, hopefully it would help a little bit.
Jumped into a septic tank.
Don't tell our kids that.
Yeah.
Don't tell our kids that. That not washing their hands creates an E. coli force field that protects them from infection.
No, they'll be like, "I'm training for the Olympics, Mom." Stop. Why are you doing that? I think we're on number five now.
I wouldn't know.
What if I said number one?
That's
and just looked at you blankly.
That's above my pay grade right now. I'm just doing the news. I can't count.
Number five.
Okay, I'll take your word for it. UConn star Paige Buchers. I find this interesting. She has signed an NIL deal with Unrivaled Basketball League. What is Unrivaled? Do you know? I don't know. It's a 3-on-3 basketball league. And what's fascinating about this is that she becomes the first NCAA athlete to receive ownership equity in a league as part of their NIL deal with that entity.
Hmm.
So the Unrivaled League was founded by former UConn stars Breonna Stewart and Nafisa Collier. They're set to begin play in 2025, and the games will take place outside of the WNBA basketball season. So she's expected to play in both the WNBA as well as this 3-on-3 league once she leaves UConn.
I think this is great that people have opportunities and go explore opportunities, but the first thing I thought about is 3-on-3 basketball in the Olympics. Kelly Graves texted me today. He's in Paris.
Yeah.
Just landed in Paris this afternoon. Or evening there.
Uh-huh.
And he is going to join us on tomorrow's show to give us kind of the lay of the Olympics.
Nice.
So he'll be with us. He's going to 3-on-3 basketball tonight, right? Probably late night there now. It is late. It was 8 o'clock when it was like 11 a.m. here.
Mm-hmm.
And then he is going to 5-on-5 basketball later. So we'll get I'm going to ask him, like, the difference between those two games from a coach's standpoint. But he said it was really difficult travel to Paris. Mm-hmm. So I want to know what he means by that.
Well, the 3-on-3 thing is interesting because this league was founded because they were trying to give women's basketball players a domestic outlet to play basketball and not have to travel overseas. And the first time I heard about 3-on-3 professionally was from my cousin who's playing it in Taiwan.
Oh, she is?
Yeah, she's doing 3-on-3.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. She says it's the next big thing.
Give your
thing.
Cousin some love. What's her name?
Sophia Song.
Just checking to see if you knew. If you remember.
Oh, that was a mental acuity.
How do you feel about this? Stanford has signed a golfer to a scholarship who will be a freshman next year. And her name is Anna Song.
Yeah.
Did you see that?
Another cousin of mine.
Did you see that? You're related to her.
I know.
I'm just checking to see if you remember.
There's some athleticism in the Song bloodline. So, apparently it skipped me.
We need to get her on the show.
Yes.
Why won't she come on?
What are you waiting for?
Why won't Anna Song come on the show? We should have her do the 5 at 5.
Yeah. She'd probably do it.
Anna, you're up for the 5 at 5. She'd be like, what?
Do you think she knows the difference between batting 168 and batting .168?
No, but she know all the golf lingo.
She is a scholarship golfer at Stanford.
Yeah.
She'll be a freshman next year. I want to get her on the show before Stanford gets their claws on her, because then they'll be like, you have to go through media relations. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, you better hurry up.
We need to do it in the next week or so.
Okay.
All right. So can you work?
I've got her number.
Can you work the phone lines?
Yeah,
and
I'll work the phone lines. I'll back channel it.
Back channel that interview.
Yeah.
Is it okay to be on the phone though with a concussion?
Text. You're not even supposed to be looking at a phone.
That's what I'm saying.
I know.
Yeah.
John just keeps swatting my phone out of my hand as I try to open Instagram or TikTok, you know?
I just find it weird.
No, he says.
Like, the day after you had the little... And by the way, can you give our folks at home an idea of what that was like to be in that little fender bender?
Yeah, it's just not fun. I was in backed up traffic north of the St. John Bridge trying to get home on Highway 30. And so we were at a standstill, and Gal came up behind us and knocked into my car. And I kind of was guessing on how her demeanor and dress, like, I think she was coming from Savi Island, you know,
oh,
on a hot day.
She was having fun at Savi Island.
So, I don't know.
Okay.
It's what it is.
You said Gal. I thought she was going to be on a horse.
Yeah.
That's what I thought.
She rode up and slammed right into my car.
Who says Gal? Steven, when's the last time you said Gal?
It's been a while. It's been a minute.
There's certain words people use that are
guys
funny,
and
right?
gals.
Do you use the word rad?
No, I say that's sick.
That's sick?
Yeah.
Do you say cool beans?
No, I'll say cool, but not beans on it.
Because he's a boy.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's a girl thing?
I think it is.
Cool beans?
Cool beans. I wouldn't say cool beans.
Sometimes I bring tight back, like, oh, it's tight.
Tight?
I get looks.
Do you say fire, Steven?
I have, just to sound dumb, just like make term old.
I play it down the middle of the fairway. I just say, oh, that's great. You know? I'm not in this to try to look cool.
Usually it's like a cool, yeah, like, oh, that's cool.
If you really are cool, you don't need to use that stuff. You don't have to say cool
No,
beans.
You just put the in front of things like Fred Meyer.
Yeah.
Well, my son will say bet all the time now. Like, oh, bet? Yeah.
Bet?
Yeah,
but
bet.
What does that mean?
I don't know. I don't know what
it
means.
Is it short for you bet? Because you bet is so hard to say.
I guess.
You just drop the you?
I was like, oh, I'm better at video games than you. And he's like, I'll bet.
Oh, and so then he's challenging you.
Kind of, I think so, yeah. And
it's
then he went off. But
let's bet on that, is what he's saying.
Huh. But it's just
maybe
bet.
That's just my family, because I'm a degenerate.
He's watching you.
Yeah.
He knows your love language.
Yeah.
So he understands.
Dad'll love me if I bet him.
He's trying to get a job at DraftKings so he can communicate with you more. That's what he's
customer
trying to
service.
Do. He would like to have more of a conversation with Dad, so he wants to get in on DraftKings. Oh, that's so bad. All right, Anna, go rest.
How'd I do?
You did all right.
All right.
Are you ready to do the 5 at 5?
Yeah, no. Let's do it.
Number
let's
one.
Roll.
No. You did fine. Now take the headset off.
Yeah.
Don't look at your phone. Don't think. Go close your eyes and give your brain a rest.
Okay.
What are you doing? Give your brain a rest. For the rest of you, leave it here.
Hey, John Kinzel.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 Whee! The Game.
Okay, Anna stepped out of the studio now, Steven. Can we talk? How'd she do? I thought she was a little bit foggy. It was a good check-in for me because she wasn't quite as sharp as she normally is.
I think she notices that she's a little like slower when she's talking. I think she just, she doesn't have the pep in her step a little bit there. But I had Coach Vaughn listening. She was listening in the car.
What'd she say?
Well, she said she sounded fine. So I don't
Could
know.
You play? We need Coach Vaughn to be like the concussion specialist on the sideline.
Hey, I know.
Get her back in the game.
She deals with that stuff. And yeah, you know, she needs a good runner. Just put her back out there. But she says she's sounding fine. Not good, not great, fine. So I think, you know, not 100%, but she played injured.
What got me was the day after she got rear-ended. And you know, you'll nod your head with me if you've ever had a family member who's had like a little car accident. And, you know, the damage to the car wasn't all that bad, but it was just like the jolt of being hit from behind. Who knows what position her head and neck were in when she got hit. But the very next morning, she was on the phone and the insurance company had called her. And I was overhearing the conversation. And she wasn't making sense. And I kind of walked over and I said, let me have the phone. And I talked to the insurance person on the phone. It was with the, you know, the national insurance person, whoever that is that you call after an accident or that calls you. And I said, hey, man, this is not a good idea. Like, she was in the ER yesterday. And now you're asking her questions about dates and times and speeds and what happened. I said, why don't you give it a couple days? And they're like, well, we were trying to, you know, I'm trying to do my job, just trying to decide who was at fault. And I was like, she got hit from behind. Clearly it's the other driver's fault. But I also think, like, just if you have questions, maybe try to go through me, because, it, you know, Anna wasn't doing well with it. Like, she had her forehead down, her eyes closed, and her face was kind of in her hands while she was answering the questions. And I was like, you should not be in that position. If you feel that way, you should be lying down, because I know this. I did this. I had talked about getting hit in the head one time a few years ago, and I didn't take the break and I didn't give myself the time off, and it affected me. I think it was 2017 that I got hit in the side of the head with a volleyball at the regional tournament in Portland at the convention center. And I took the volleyball in the head and I thought no big deal. And then I walked about 15 or 20 yards and I was like, whoa, concussion. And then I just felt kind of crummy for the rest of the day. And then I had to work, and then I was doing radio and doing whatever else and writing at the paper, and there was no day off. There was no time to take time off. And I just had to keep going and going. I think I would have been far better off if I had just taken like 2 days off, because that's a brain injury. Like, your brain is, it needs a chance to heal. And so if you have a concussion, we know far more about concussions than we did when I was a kid. You know, we played football, we got a concussion, we went back in the game. They look at you, they'd ask you a stupid question like, do you know what your name is? Do you know what day it is? Do you know what your phone number is? Well, those are not great questions to determine if you have a concussion or not. A lot of it is, you know, how are your pupils doing? How do you feel? And you need some time to evaluate that. Now I think we're much more tuned into that because of CTE and whatnot. But I think generationally, we had so many people that were probably walking around concussed. And then what happens? You get another concussion because you don't allow yourself to heal. So it took me a while. It took me a lot longer to get to 100% than it would have if I just took some time off. So I'm glad she hasn't done the 5 at 5 for several days. And we've kind of laid low, but there's a trickle-down effect, Stephen. You and I were talking about this before the show. You're a team. You and your wife are a team. Me and Anna, we're a team. And so when it comes to kind of managing the household, what I suddenly found was, like, I wanted her to rest. So some things that are normally, like, things she does, I started having to do them, like, 2 or 3 days ago. And I was like, holy hell, this feels, like, really busy for me. But I just don't want her stressed out and overtaxed and, you know, having a recurrence or having like concussion symptoms that go beyond what they should. So,
yeah. And the kids don't understand either at that point. Like, they just think, oh, mom has a headache. And so, you know, she can still do everything for us. So, the trickle down effect is real. And luckily, for me, like, I have a good support system and community that I have around me that helps me out. Yes. So, but yeah, it's tough.
And the kids don't know, because I tell the kids, like, hey, you got to keep it down. Any loud noises, bright lights, you know, like yelling and screaming, you guys coming into the room that way. Can't do that right now. You got to give mom a break. And it took the 8-year-old about like 3 reminders where I kept having to look at her and she'd go, oh, sorry. But I even did it one time. I walked into the room and I immediately started talking to her, and she looked up at me, and I could tell from the expression on her face that she was dazed by the fact that I had come into the room suddenly, and I was suddenly peppering her with questions, and I was like, oh, I shouldn't do that. So, you know, if somebody in your family has a concussion, try to give them a break. Don't pull them onto the 5 at 5 like I did to her. She mentioned the Mariners player, Mitch Garver, who says he's getting death threats, and it hasn't been easy, and he's hitting 168, and, you know, he's a 230, 240 hitter in his career, in his major league career. He had a great season a year ago where he hit 270-plus, but only his career has he ever been above 270 twice. In 2019, he hit 273. In 2023, he hit 270. Every other year, it's been 207, 256, 167, 268, 196. Now he's at 168. More often than not, he has been under 250 than over 250. So my question is this. What do you make of fans who issue death threats to athletes who aren't performing? What is that about? What is going wrong in your life that you feel like, hey, this guy isn't coming through for me, I'm going to give him death threats? What is going on with Mitch Garver getting death threats?
Just loser mentality by these fans. Like, I understand there's certain players that I don't like, that I didn't like watching play the sport of my team. Like, there's been plenty of Blazers that I hated watching on the court, but I would never want anything bad to happen to them. Like, just because I feel like I'm a somewhat sane person. It's just a loser mentality where that is the only thing that matters in your life. And I love sports. You know, we work in sports. I don't know what my life would be without it, but I don't want people to die over it. Like, it's not that big of a deal, even if it is your own team. Like, I don't know. I hate that kind of stuff. It puts bad, because there's so many good fans out there. It puts just a bad blanket on everybody.
And here's the thing. Like, here's the messages he's getting. People are telling him to retire. People are telling him you suck. People are saying bleeping, kill yourself. And Ryan Divish posted on Twitter about this. Ryan Divish does such a good job covering the Mariners. He's the best. Seattle Times. He said, posted this great story, but Garver's hitting 168 through 89 games. Worst in his career when you look at strikeouts, but he has had several seasons where he hit under 200. But I think part of this is the fact that the Mariners as a team they're the last place team when it comes to team batting average. There's no protection in that lineup. The trades they made prior to the trade deadline underscore kind of the problem that the Mariners have. I think that the Mariners' struggles really are related to the cumulative effect of having a bad lineup. And what happens is, and anybody who's been around baseball will tell you that, like when you start layering good hitter after good hitter in a lineup, everybody gets better. Everybody benefits from the fact that you've got a good leadoff hitter. The two hitter becomes a little better because he sees more fastballs because the leadoff hitter is on base. Now the three hitter is getting pitches to hit two because there's runners on base and the pitcher doesn't want to face the cleanup hitter who's your home run hitter. And what happens if you have a good five hitter? You can't walk your cleanup hitter, or you can't pitch around him. And so there's a layered effect to any lineup, but especially in baseball. And the same can be said of a good NFL team on offense. If you're the San Francisco 49ers and you have Debo Samuel, who's really good, and you have George Kittle, who you can't just cover with a linebacker, and you have Christian McCaffrey, who out of the backfield is one of the best receivers as a running back in the league, and you have a Brandon Ayuk who can lead your team in receptions and yards because he's good enough, suddenly everybody's a little better, because as a defense you can't concentrate on Kittle or you can't concentrate on Debo. It's like playing whack-a-mole as a defensive coordinator. And so the same is said of a good offense, but the same is said of a bad offense. When you have an offense that doesn't have a great leadoff hitter, suddenly the two hitter is, you know, on an island. Is nobody on base. He's not getting all those fastballs. Suddenly the three hitter has nobody on base. Pitcher can pitch around the best hitter or two in the lineup because they know there's no one after him. And as a lineup, the Mariners are struggling I think because they just don't have any kind of congruency. There's no check and balance for the pitcher.
It's literally the trickle-down effect, what we were just talking about. I mean,
yes.
And it's the same thing in all sports. I mean, we've seen guys that have had really good stats, whether it's in baseball or basketball or football, when they're on a really good team, and then they go to a poor team, and they're the lead option. And they just can't handle it because they're not that good. They're a good player, but they're not a great player. And I think that's what Mitch Garver is. Like, when you put him in the lineup and he can bat seventh or eighth, awesome. That's great. But with the Mariners right now, he's batting fourth. He's batting fifth. He's right in the middle of the lineup. He's getting no support. And that's the problem, is then you put too much pressure on these type of guys that just can't handle it. And that's okay. Not everyone can handle that type of pressure of being the star player on the team. You just got to realize that. And so I think for fans, like, they have to realize, like, look, Mitch Garver, it's not all his fault. He's not the only reason why the Mariners can't hit. There's a lot of guys around him that can't hit.
I also am watching the acquisitions as Randy Arozarena is, traded to the Mariners. Some people on the outside go, that's not a game changer as a hitter. But it certainly is for the Mariners, because when you take a Justin Turner, who they also traded for, and Arozarena, and you put them both in the lineup, one at the top and maybe one at the bottom, you suddenly have a lineup that is a little better top to bottom, and it makes the two guys in front of them, or the guy in front of them, the guy behind them, a little better. There's just a cumulative effect there that I think the Mariners were desperate for. And so I'm eager to see kind of how that shakes out as the season goes on, as the Mariners are, four games over 500, second in the American League West. But I'm eager to see, like, does the lineup get that? Does it get markedly better? And again, from an NBA standpoint, let's think about this. Let's say you have a decent big man, but your point guard's not very good. He's not a playmaker. And you don't have a three that can really shoot. He's more of a defender. And you suddenly, at the trade deadline, get a veteran point guard who at least can play smart. And you get, a three that, not only can defend, but can shoot a little bit. Your center's better now, right? Because your center now, teams can't double your center. If they do, then those other two guys are going to feast. But that's kind of what the Mariners are trying to do here. So let's watch this unfold. And it's possible that your designated hitter who is struggling, Mitch Garver, in hitting 168, it's possible that guy is about to, improve himself by 30 or 40 points of batting average. It doesn't take that much for Mitch Garver to suddenly 0-for-3. Suddenly now he's, he's 1-for-3. Or, he's just getting a little better pitches, got better guys around him in the lineup. Let's see how this plays out. Leave it here. You got the BFT.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Yeah, nobody should be making death threats to an athlete, death threats to a radio show host. I had death threats. Steven, were you around? I don't think you were around when Death Threat Guy was around.
No, I don't think I was.
He was an Oregon fan who was mad that I was, critical of the Chip Kelly era Ducks. And, I got some death threats. And I think I can play this on air. Steven, I think I can. I want to maybe clear this with you first, though. I should just play it and see what happens. Okay, here was threatening voicemail number one that I received. This was many years ago during the Chip Kelly era. And what happened was law enforcement told me to play these on air because they believe somebody would recognize this person's voice. And after several weeks of this person calling and threatening, they stopped when I started playing them on air. Which told me, too, they knew. And I think law enforcement started to zero in on this person. But here's an example of a sports fan losing their compass?
All you do is try to tear down the Oregon program at every opportunity, man. That's what you do. You get right up on a soapbox. They have to suspend him. Chip Kelly's making mistakes, and you have a personal issue with them. That's why I have a personal issue with you. You go work in another market if you don't like Oregon football, because that's what runs the state, bitch. You are a man. Just a
okay. There's voicemail number one. Initial thoughts, Steven?
This guy's a little off his rocker. That's what I thought of.
Okay. I mean, the fact that it means that much, first of all.
Just the fact that it was just that he disagrees with your opinion, basically. Like, that's why I'm
very personal.
Just,
very personal to this caller. Voicemail number two is right here.
Do this, but I hope that some really awesome killer duck fan walks up to you, slices your throat in public, and pisses on your face and laughs and goes to jail proudly. I hope that somebody does that. I would never do that because I have too much to live for, right? So I wouldn't go and jeopardize my future by killing a low-life scumbag punk like you. But I'm hoping that there's a duck fan out there that's just crazy enough, you know what I mean? Just a little bit nutty. And decides public execution for John Canzano is the only way that it's going to make a point that pieces of shit like you don't have any place up here. Leave now.
What do you make of that?
That got extreme real quick. It's just for a disagreeing with your opinion, like that's the level they go to. I also like the fact that he said, well, I have so much more to live for. Well, obviously you don't, because you're obsessed with the Ducks.
And you're calling, leaving a voicemail in the middle of the night.
You don't have to listen, right? Like, he doesn't have to listen to your opinion if he doesn't want to.
No. It got worse. It got worse. And for me, this is where I got law enforcement involved. And because they said, hey, play it on air. Against your better judgment, play it on air. And what happened was they started to get tips with people who knew who this individual was. Now, the person immediately stopped calling and went, oh, wait a minute. Maybe they saw themselves in the mirror. I don't know. But have not heard from this person in a long time. Here's number three.
The first time you fuck up, everybody's going to pile on your stupid ass. Your stupid big mouth talking about everybody else and how they should act. Oh, I can't wait. First parking ticket I find out about. You can't live like normal people now. You open up your big mouth too much. First thing, I really want to hear about Dakota and Anna more on the radio, by the way. More information. I think you need to put more information out there about your two lovey-dovey girls, the women that you love, right? We want to hear more about Dakota and Anna on the radio. Give us some more information, John. Tell us more about what. How tall is Dakota these days? How much does she weigh? Color's her hair. Does she have any nicknames that we should all know about? That's the kind of stuff that I want to hear. The inside information, John. Start giving me the inside information. See what we can do with it.
Law enforcement heard that one and said he's now delving into threats against your then 9-year-old daughter who was at an elementary school. And they told me to play it on air, Stephen, and I did, and it stopped. Because the coward who left those messages heard his own voice on air. Maybe he recognized the stupidity and the absurdity of what he was saying. But also, I think more importantly, he got scared that other people would recognize that voice. And other people started to call. And I got a call from police who said, you know, depending how far you want to go with this, you know, this, we can make this a thing. And for me, it was never really about trying to like hunt this person down and find this person and ascertain, you know, the level of sanity that this human being had. I mean, frankly, if you get a restraining order against someone, part of that process with the courts, as I found out, is that you have to put down your address and you have to put down your kid's elementary school. And you know, there's public information out there that I don't necessarily think protects the person it's supposed to protect in the way that it's designed to do. But that 10-year-old is no longer 10. She's 21. And I got a feeling that if that individual tried to approach her with that kind of tone, he would get bear spray in his face. You know, I mean, I can't stress this enough. If Mitch Garver's family is being threatened by Mariners fans who are unhappy that he's hitting 168, get a life if you're that person who is tweeting at him, who is DMing him, who's reaching out on Instagram, who's sending an anonymous cowardly email or voicemail or whatever means by which you are disappointed and decide to reach out and try to antagonize Mitch Garver and his family. I can tell you from somebody who is at least peripherally dealt with weirdos that you are a weirdo and keep yourself in check. Maybe hearing that guy helps somebody else from not reaching out to Mitch Garver or some other athlete when they're struggling. Steven, any thoughts in hearing that last voicemail?
Just gross. Just gross and sickening. It makes me mad and sad that people are like this in the world, man. I just sorry that you had to go through that.
I accept it. I'm on the radio.
But it's just sports, and that's the thing. We can all think differently for your own team. You're never going to make it personal. It's all about just what you see.
But what got me is when he dragged the 9-year-old and Anna into the conversation.
It's just gross.
I suspect he heard himself and went, "Oh my gosh, that is so ugly. I'm ashamed of that." It stopped after we played it on air. Well, I haven't played it in a long time. But hearing about Mitch Garver made me think about it. Keep yourself in check. Keep your feet on the ground. We're back tomorrow with another great show. The Bald-Faced Truth, not here for a long time, just a good time. Summer.